And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, May the 10th, 2016, 1:14 coming up on 1:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we are going to have a fun hour this hour because we are going to talk to a gentleman who has had his hand in a lot of the most famous cases, assassinations, murders, issues of our time. He is world famous forensic pathologist, Dr. Cyril Wecht. Dr. Wecht, how are you?
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Good to talk with you. I want to start out the interview before we get to the high profile cases you've been involved with. I want to learn a little background about you. What was your childhood like?
Well, an only child, the loving parents, both of whom immigrants, my father from Lithuania, my mother from Russia. They had a mom-and-pop grocery store for my first year, which I don't remember, a small town, pop town in Greene County near the West Virginia border, and 7 years in McKees Rocks, suburb of Allegheny County, which is where Governor Kasich is from, by the way. And then we moved to what we refer to as the Lower Hill District, uptown, just a little bit up from downtown Pittsburgh. Probably lower middle class community, I would say, hardworking people, many of whom were first generation Americans. And I went to school there. And then I went to University of Pittsburgh, got my undergraduate degree, then medical school, Buffalo and Pitt, and graduated with my MD degree. Then a year of internship, then started the 2 years of residency at the University VA Hospital, and I went into the Air Force for 2 years. I'd been deferred through college and medical school, served as a captain in the United States Air Force, and as an associate pathologist at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. And then I came out, finished up in forensic pathology at the Baltimore Medical Examiner's Office. In the meantime, I had gone to law school a couple years at Pitt while I was doing my residency, and then I did my last year of law school in the evening at the University of Maryland while I was doing my fellowship in forensic pathology. My childhood was fine. It was a lot of fun. We played on the street. It was a relatively poor, I don't mean poor, but you know, we didn't have playgrounds or anything. A lot of the footballs sometimes were made up of rolled newspapers tied with a rubber band. But, everybody ate well and lived well, and there were no significant problems. I was active through high school. It's a whole different world. 70% African-American fellow students, and I was elected president of the class every year, every semester. I'm just pointing that out, that things have changed in America. And I, you know, played football and basketball, and then it University of Pittsburgh, I was very active. I was president of the student body and president of my fraternity and concert master of the orchestra and vice president, varsity debater, and a few other things. I was very proud to be elected by my fellow students as president of the YMCA, although I'm Jewish, something I've always been very proud of, which kind of speaks for itself. So anyway, that's my background. Then I got married and met my wife in the Air Force. She's from Norway. She had come hoping to go to school, become a translator. She spoke 7-8 languages. Of course, they lied to her, as they always do. She was sent to the base where I was. And then we got married when I got out, and 4 wonderful kids, all of whom were very fortunate, live in Allegheny County. My oldest son was elected to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court last year, and my second son is a neurosurgeon, and my third son is director of our Wecht Institute of Forensic Science and Law at Duquesne University, and my daughter is an obstetrician and gynecologist, and we have 11 grandchildren, so we're very, very fortunate. And I am still very busy and active, perhaps more so than ever before. And my wife, who's also an attorney and has a graduate degree in public and national affairs, also handles things in the office and deals with my consultations. I'm very busy doing autopsies. I did 456 autopsies last year. I already have over 170 this year, and I teach a full course at Duquesne University School of Law, and I have faculty positions at University of Pittsburgh in the Medical School and Graduate School of Public Health, and also at Carle University. I'm a distinguished professor of pathology. We have an excellent program we established in forensic science and autopsies and so on. And I'm very busy writing and lecturing and so on. I have a new textbook that just came out about a week ago on forensic pathology in civil and criminal cases. So that is a rapid background. Now you know everything.
And I do. Except, what in those primitive years made you turn your attention toward medicine?
The answer is very simple. As an only child of Jewish immigrant parents, my father, he told me, and of course I don't remember, but it's subliminal, I guess from the day I was born, you're going to be a doctor, you'll be a doctor, you'll be a doctor. So I never thought otherwise until, all the way through. And then somewhere along in medical school, I began to think, maybe I could combine law and medicine, because I told you I've been very active in student involvement and affairs and activities, and I always liked politics, and in fact remained active in politics. I forgot to mention I was elected coroner for 20 years, two separate 10-year periods in Allegheny County. I was elected county commissioner. I was the nominated Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate in 1982, running against the incumbent, Joan Hines. An interesting campaign, a bit underfunded on my part. The answer to your question is, and I'm not being the least bit facetious, it is true. I just never thought of anything else. Not that my father, I guess you could call it brainwashing. I don't know. So I just thought, I'm going to be a doctor. So I went into college and became a pre-med student and applied to medical school and so on. And then I guess because of my interest in other things along with medicine, then I got that legal education. Then when I combined the two of them, I was, of course, thinking about what specialty in medicine is most frequently involved at the interface of law and medicine. And clearly and unquestionably, it is pathology, more specifically forensic pathology. Think of all the things that you deal with as a forensic pathologist, not only death cases, but everything else. So, I forgot to mention that I'm very busy also with medical legal consultations for attorneys throughout the United States and occasionally in foreign countries in civil matters, plaintiff defense, in criminal matters, prosecution, or defense. I do autopsies for coroners in four surrounding counties now. I'm no longer in the Allegheny County Medical Examiner's Office. It became an ME office. Changed in 2006. But I do the autopsies for Armstrong, Fayette, Greene, and Westmoreland counties in southwestern Pennsylvania. Then I do consultations for attorneys on an independent basis. They deal with medical malpractice. I may be consulted by defense attorneys in homicide cases elsewhere outside the jurisdictions where I do my cases. And all kinds of products, liability, insurance claims involving cause of death, workers' compensation, drug cases, and so on. So those two are part of what I do. So my choice of medicine was laid out for me from that early age, and I'm very happy that my father did it, but I'm glad that I then decided to go into forensic pathology and legal medicine, which makes medicine more interesting for me.
You talked about it there, doing many, many autopsies over the course of your career and just in recent years. What basically goes on in an autopsy?
Well, by the way, I've done about 20,000 autopsies myself since I began to do them some 55 years or so ago. And I have reviewed, supervised, signed off on about 40,000 other autopsies. So what goes on is, well, in the hospital, of course, you and I was chairman of the Department of Pathology for 25 years at a hospital in Pittsburgh and had been affiliated with other hospitals, too. I have no hospital affiliation at this time. In a hospital, you get permission from the family for coroner's cases, medical examiner's cases. Permission is not sought nor required. The coroner, medical examiner, decides whether that case falls under his or her jurisdiction, and then you you take the body in. So the body is brought to me. We do all our autopsies at Carlo University in the Oakland section of Pittsburgh, if anybody's familiar with Pittsburgh, just a half a mile or less from the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University. The body's brought to me. First, we're notified, of course, by the coroner, and my assistant sets everything up. And then many times it'll be accompanied by a state trooper or a county detective, sometimes a local law enforcement officer, but more frequently the state police, in homicides, possible homicides, and other cases of a suspicious or potentially controversial nature. And the body's identified, photographs are taken, and then we proceed. I describe the clothing on the individual, and then more photographs are taken. And if you have wounds, stab wounds, shooting injuries, blunt force trauma, and so on, then you'll take photographs of those. Collect sometimes evidence externally. It might be fingernail scrapings, hair. Women, in many instances, you'll take oral, vaginal, and rectal swabs in case you know, any question comes up about sexual assault later on. And then, after that's all done, you proceed with the actual cutting of the decedent. There are basically two incisions, one over the top of the head, from behind one ear over the top of the skull to the other. You reflect the scalp. You use an electric saw to take off the top of the skull, the calvarium, it is called, and then you have access to the brain, the 12 cranial nerves that emanate from the brain, its coverings, the vascular supply, etc. Then you make a Y-shaped incision in the front of the body. You start at the anterior crest of each shoulder, moving downward diagonally, and then continuing from the lower chest in a straight line. Hence referred to as a Y-shaped thoracoabdominal incision, because it has that configuration. You reflect the skin, subcutaneous tissues, and skeletal muscles, and so on. Then you cut out the breastbone, the sternum, and you now have access then to all the organs and tissues in the chest cavities, the heart, and the abdominal and pelvic cavities. And you examine everything in place. You take pictures, if necessary and relevant. Collect specimens for toxicology, blood, bile, B-I-L-E, from the gallbladder, urine. And then organs are removed, usually one by one. They're weighed, they're palpated, they're measured, and they're described. And then they are dissected in different ways, depending upon which organ it is, and you look and see what you have, and you take small pieces that you retain for microscopic slides, just like a hospital pathologist will take an appendix or a lung tumor sent down to him from the operating room, and he'll describe it and make sections and look at the microscopic slides the next day. So it was the same thing with us, only we don't usually do it day to day. But anyway, you save those tissues for microscopic slide preparation as needed. And the specimens are sent off to a toxicology laboratory for the analysis. Then you get that back, all that information, Sometimes you wait for a police report, etc. And then, meantime, my secretary types up my report. Unlike probably most pathologists who dictate later, I dictate as I go along. I like to do that. Body's in front of me, and I find it best to dictate rather than take a bunch of notes and have to deal with them later. There's nothing like having the body there. So I do my dictation, individual tapes, give them to my secretary. She types up the rough draft, I correct it, and then when all the other information comes back, toxicology, etc., that I've referred to, then I put it together, type up the final report, goes back to the coroner. I do autopsies for private families. Also, by the way, I have a body being sent to me tomorrow from Chicago. The people contacted me, and they're having me send out somebody. I don't have the livery service that I run, but I mean somebody that we contact. He's going out, pick up the body, bring it back. I'll do the autopsy. I just did a private autopsy last week on a body from Ohio. I've had body. It doesn't happen every day or every week, but I have bodies that may be sent to me from California or Florida or wherever. I prefer that rather than going there. Actually, believe it or not, saves them money. That's not the main reason, but it's less costly to them to send the body than it is for me to go there. And then the body's returned. If it's, geographically feasible, it'll usually be by van, livery service set up by them or by me. And, of course, if it's a greater distance, then the body will be flown back. That's the story. And private autopsies, I deal directly with the legal next of kin who requested the autopsy. Everything is done in the same fashion that I just described, and the report goes to them. So that's about maybe 10% of all the autopsies I do. 90% plus are these cases that I do for the coroners in the four counties I refer to.
Why do you think that the people in Chicago, the people in Ohio, the people in California want Dr. Wecht to do these autopsies? What are you finding that other people are not looking for?
Well, no, it's not that I'm going to find things that other people. They're very competent pathologists all around. Number one, there aren't that many forensic pathologists, however, who do private autopsies. Some of them who work full-time in medical examiners' offices may be prohibited. Others just choose not to be involved because they're very busy and just don't want to be bothered, and they don't have a setup and so on. So in my case, I just felt that I wanted to do private autopsies and autopsies for other coroners, which I was even doing legitimately and openly when I was coroner of Allegheny County. Why do they contact me? Well, I think that my name is out there because of many of the high profile cases that I've been involved in and programs that I'm on. In fact, by the way, if this is a live program, then I'll mention that I'm on a program tonight at 10 o'clock. It's a new series that's starting on one of the investigation channels, and it's a case, I don't think it was my case, but it's a case that they came to an interview. And then when I finish up with my conversation with you today, I'm going in, people have come from New York, and they're setting up in another room. They're going to interview me on a case that I dealt with back in 1996, the Menendez brothers. I don't know whether you remember that or not. I don't know how old you are.
Oh, yes.
These were two teenage boys that killed their parents, shot their parents with a shotgun 14 times in their affluent home setting there in Los Angeles. And so they're going to be interviewing me. So I guess, people here come to know my name from these programs and comments that I make. Like 2 weeks ago, I was on many television programs talking about the Prince death. And, you know, that's just an example of something that has occurred most recently. So then they think of me, they or their attorneys who are handling cases, and I don't advertise. So, and of course, I guess nowadays, and I'm not into this technology, but I know my kids and my wife press a button and you can come up with anything in the world. You just press a button and it's all there, including Joe Jones, where he lives and everything, maybe even what he had for breakfast, and did he change his underwear that day, and did he smoke marijuana when he went to high school. I mean, what isn't known? So, and not very hard to find that, right? Push the button and you'll find out who's available to do what.
You'll get the information. Do you like the high-profile cases?
Do I like what?
The high-profile cases.
Well, yeah, sure. They're exciting. And they become controversial. Of course, the controversial nature undoubtedly is fueled by the fact that the news media are involved. They're not going to be involved or concerned about you or me or your next-door neighbor or whatever. But once a case involves a celebrity or a case becomes one of celebrity status, people that were, you know, not really known to anybody before. Good examples that come to mind right away, JonBenet Ramsey, you know, beautiful little six-year-old girl, had some, you know, involvement to local beauty contests, but nobody knew JonBenet Ramsey, and aren't little kids regrettably, tragically brutalized and murdered somewhere every week in America? How come we don't hear about Susie and Bobby and Joni and Tommy and so on? I don't know. Lacey Peterson, a case I did a second autopsy on, her and her infant found floating in San Francisco Bay. You know, I mean, in fact, around that same time, there was another woman found floating in the bay out there. It was almost a twin case that not one person in 10 million knows anything about. And yet, Lacey Peterson became a famous case. Other cases, of course, are famous going in, like O.J. Simpson and Phil Spector and Elvis Presley, and obviously the John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King assassinations, by virtue of who those people are. But do I enjoy it? Yes, I enjoy the challenge. I enjoy dealing with these, and some of them have very interesting questions. Dealing with sometimes the cause of death and very often the manner of death, and sometimes, of course, with assassinations, the who did it question. So, yes, those are interesting, challenging, and, you know, sometimes you can get a little frustrated or upset by things that happen, and being on national television programs when you're not in studio and you have to get your word in or so on, or you're cut off, or you're sitting there for an hour and they forget to get to you or don't get to you till the last few minutes. But that's another matter. But yes, those are interesting cases, and I'm very happy to have been involved in them, and I have enjoyed writing 8 different books for public consumption that deal with most of these famous cases, in, you know, different cases in different books that I've written, going back now, I guess over the past, I don't know, maybe 20 years or so. I have about 45 or 48 books that I've written, co-authored, co-edited on the professional side, but there are 8 books that are out there for the public that are written for them that deal with these famous cases, which contain some, you know, very interesting information, not the things that I have, that only I in the world know, but things for one reason or another that never came to be known or were never disclosed publicly. Not that I stole something or breached security or confidentiality, but things that never get out, like the Hurricane Katrina cases in New Orleans, where the woman doctor deliberately injected these people and killed them with massive doses of analgesics and so on. And that information never got anywhere because it was never presented to the grand jury. And they were just interested in covering up and making her look like a big heroine because she stuck around for a few days when everybody else went home So sometimes, and then things behind the scenes that, again, are not confidential, but which were private and not really part of, and they make for fascinating reading. So these cases, indeed, are enjoyable, and the as I've commented, the fascinating thing about them is they keep coming back. What? You know, like this Menendez case I'm going to be dealing with now in a half an hour or so, whatever. You know, I hadn't heard from anybody in that case for, what, 1996? 26, my God, that's 20 years. I just did a Marilyn Monroe case. I don't know when that'll be shown. And then I referred to one. It's going to be, this is not a famous case, but an interesting case. It'll be on Investigation TV tonight at 10 p.m. And then I know I was recently interviewed again on the Elvis Presley case. So these cases retain a high level of interest and fascination among people. They're, you know, people like celebrities, and they'd like to read about them.
And because of that, and in the last 20 minutes we have here, I want to go through a few of these, because we've been involved in some way through interviews over the years with some people involved in these. And, of course, want to start with the big one of all time. That's JFK. Recently, we had Jim Lovell on, who was the man in the white suit, the Dallas police officer, who was handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald when he was shot. He says Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy. He has no doubt about it. He was there when Lee Harvey Oswald was killed. What's your opinion?
Well, he's wrong, and the forensic scientific investigation proves he's wrong. Before you even get to all the other matters, and they are relevant and important, all of the things of a political nature, all of the things involving Lee Harvey Oswald, who he was, how he got to Russia, 2.5 years there, his marriage to Marina, the niece of a KGB colonel. Before you get to any of that and all the games that were played by the FBI and the CIA, just start with the assassination itself. And I don't mean to be critical of Mr. Lovell or anybody else, but, you know, they're not forensic scientists. And then people who are forensic scientists, they just ignore or find some disingenuous way to get around it. Let's start with something that is very, very basic. It is the single bullet theory, as the Warren Commission called it. I labeled it a long time ago, as did Mark Lane and others, the magic bullet theory. The single bullet theory is a sine qua non of the Warren Commission report's conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald was a sole assassin. If you do not have a single, I want to make this very clear, if you do not have a single bullet theory, you have, by definition, two shooters. Forget who they are, whether Oswald was one of them. You have two shooters. So what is the single bullet theory? The single bullet theory came into being because the Warren Commission was faced in March, April of 64 as they proceeded with a seemingly physically incongruous incongruity that defied resolution and could only be handled with this cockamamie single bullet theory. They correlated the timing of the Zapruder film. Abraham Zapruder, a woman's clothing merchant, took film that day at Dealey Plaza. Camera and film strip were examined, and then you take individual frames of this 8mm film strip, blow it up 11 by 15 pictures, and you know then, and the camera was tested by Bill Howe, FBI, at 18 and a third frames move through the camera per second. So you take these individual shots and you move around a table, as I did at Life magazine headquarters in December of 65. Life had purchased a film from Zapruder. And just think about this. Think about this as you move around these X-ray view boxes that are laid up for you to look down upon them. You move in circuitous fashion from one picture to another, and you study the assassination of President Kennedy at 1/18-second intervals. There's not a thought you can utter, a word you can speak, a movement you can make 18 times in 1 second. So they had that in place. And then they had the Mannlicher Carcano, the alleged murder weapon, which is a non-automatic bolt-action weapon, considered by all long gun experts as the most inferior weapon of his genre developed anywhere in the world. And they said that was a murder weapon, and they found that it took 2.3 seconds from shot to shot. Shoot, unload, reload, not allowing time for repositioning and re-aiming at a moving target, forgetting about accuracy. What was the time required? 2.3 seconds. Well, that didn't fit, because the Zapruder film clearly shows Governor Connally seated in front of the president being shot and wounded 1.5 seconds after Kennedy has been hit the first time. So there they are. I wasn't with them, but just picture this. Lee Harvey Oswald is dead. J. Edgar Hoover has told the world that the case is all over, that Oswald is a sole assassin. Well, how do you handle this? Well, that's when Arlen Specter, then junior legal counsel, later to become U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, came up with a single bullet theory. Said Specter, what if one bullet went into Kennedy's back, exited his neck, re-entered Connally's back, pierced the right lung, shattered 4 inches of the right fifth rib, exited from the front of the chest, re-entered the back of Connally's right wrist, shattered the distal end of the radius, one of the two big bones from the elbows of the wrist, exited from the front of the wrist, re-entered the left thigh and fell out. What if one bullet did that? And that will solve our problem of the seemingly impossible dilemma we are confronted with between the timing of the Mallinckrodt-Carcano weapon and the Zapruder film. So I love to do this. Every time I speak to an audience, I get two people up, and I seat them as they are the president and Governor Connally, and I show the trajectory of this bullet. It comes out of Connally's neck, of Kennedy's neck. Kennedy's neck, it's moving forward and to the left and downward. First, as it goes through him from back to front, it goes upward 11.5 degrees. The shot having been fired from the sixth-floor window, it's moving upward 11.5 degrees. Then it's coming out and moving to the left. It turns in midair, goes 18 inches, slams into Connally behind the right armpit, proceeds downward below the nipple level. The Zapruder film clearly shows that when Connally is shot, he's holding a Texas White Stetson above nipple level, shoulder level. The bullet proceeds upward and around, gets into the back of his wrist, and goes down into his left thigh. That's the single-bullet theory, okay? So just for starters, before you go anywhere else, not to suggest that that's the beginning and the end of the case, then that's the beginning to show that the Warren Commission report is sheer utter nonsense. It's only the beginning of what this case is all about, and that's why this case is so important. It wasn't the Russians, wasn't the Chinese, wasn't the Cubans. In the words of that immortal, wonderful comic strip character, a possum named Pogo, we have met the enemy, and he is us. This was the killing of the president, the assassination of our leader. It was the overthrow of the government. It was coup d'etat in America. That's what it was. In that respect, for any of your listeners who are into this seriously, get a book by David Talbot, a renowned scholar, called Devil's Chessboard. Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot. And you'll see who did this and what it was all about. It was all about politics and how do you get rid of the Kennedys. You can't do it in the ballot box. John's there for 5 more years to be followed by Bobby Kennedy for 8 years. 13 years, you don't just sit by and say, well, wait till it's our turn. This isn't a ball game. You can't wait 13 years with what was going on in the country and in the world. So that's why the JFK case is so important.
That being said, without going out and buying the book, or reading the book, and I'm sure people will, because I'm sure there's a lot of interesting facts in there, was it a single person? Was it a group of people?
No, not a single person. I don't know exactly how many people sat down and made the ultimate decision. I have no way of knowing that. The key player in all this was Alan Dulles, who, ironically, amazingly, had been director of the CIA, was bounced out of office, removed by John Kennedy following the Bay of Pigs fiasco, when it was revealed that Dulles had lied and that Dulles was running his own government through the CIA and overthrowing governments around the world, Allende in Chile, Arbenz in Guatemala, the M brothers in Vietnam, any place that he, Dulles, and his top CIA people did not feel was in America's best interest, he just arranged their elimination one way or another, political overthrow or actual physical assassination. And then, of course, others at the top level. I can't tell you who my own personal thought is. I will bet you that there couldn't have been, I bet you there weren't six people, maybe three or four, whatever, who made the ultimate decision. And then, of course, it's, you know, on a basis to know, you do this, Joe, and you do this, Tom, and so on. And they used the mafia, Jack Ruby was mafia, to eliminate Oswald as a prime example, to make sure that he's out of the picture. There would never be a trial of Lee Harvey Oswald for all of these things to come out. That was essential. And when you ask who, these are ultra-right-wing, super patriotic people. These are the kinds of people, you know, when the Star Spangled Banner is played and the flag is waving, they hear and see something more than you and me as just plain regular Americans. They know what is best for America, and that was it. And they ran the show. And keep in mind, people often ask, how could you do this, how you get away with it, and so on. Pre-Watergate, pre-Vietnam, 63, you know, news media, you didn't ask questions. And I mean, they just, they're the investigated reporters that we know about. This stuff didn't exist. I mean, Franklin, just you know, not to digress, but to make my point, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he had a mistress. Eisenhower had a mistress. John Kennedy had girlfriends. He brought one of them, Judy Eisenhower, into the White House. You think that nobody knew about this? Of course they did. The point I'm making is this just wasn't talked about. It's well documented and proven by now that both John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy had sexual affairs with Marilyn Monroe. So how come we? So when people say to me, "Gee, how come? How could this have been? How could this have occurred? How could anybody have done this and gotten away with it?" We're still today, in 2016, we're still learning some things about World War II, about the Korean War, about the Vietnam War that have been held up by the government. There are about tens of thousands of papers and documents still being retained at the National Archives in the Kennedy assassination that have not yet been released. And that is part of what we're doing with the National Organization, working hard to get all of these things released, which they are supposed to do by congressional enactment in 1992, in 25 years that these documents are to be released. So we're working for that. So the back to your question is, you know, who did it and why? Because of what was going on. Kennedy was going to pull out of the Vietnam War. Kennedy was working on a detente with Russia, the Cold War situation. Kennedy was making a lot of changes elsewhere. Kennedy was really, really teed off on the Bay of Pigs. They lied to him about what they were going to do. And then domestically, you had the voting rights and the civil rights, you know. So you don't just sit back if you see your country going to hell in the basket. You got to do something. And how do you do it? You're not going to beat the Kennedys at the polls. Forget about that. So how do you handle it? You eliminate them. That's how you handle it.
The last one I want to touch on with about 8 minutes left is Elvis Presley, because we had Elvis's personal physician, Dr. George Nikopoulos, on the show.
Uh-huh.
He didn't do a whole lot.
Old Dr. Nick, yeah.
Old Dr. Nick, who didn't do a whole lot of interviews, but he passed away earlier on this year. But when he was on, he said he sat in on the autopsy because he wanted to, and he felt that Elvis had died from some issues with having too much intestine, colon problems. Wish he would have kept a closer eye on that medical.
Well,
okay. What's the story there?
He had colon problems. He had a colon that had a diameter of an average man's thigh, and he spent 4-6 hours a day in the bathroom, courtesy of Dr. Nick. He died from 11 or 12 central nervous system depressant drugs, uppers, benzodiazepines, tranquilizers, sedatives, antidepressants, anxiolytics, all prescribed by good old Dr. Nick. Whatever Elvis wanted, Dr. Nick wrote the prescription. Nikopoulos was suspended. I think he lost his license for a while or permanently, whatever. And so, colon problems. Where did the colon? He was a young man, 42, 43. He was a young guy. I mean, he was in good health. That case was finessed. The autopsy should have been done by the medical examiner's office. They knew that if they did it, the results would get out sooner or later. So they said it was going to be a private autopsy. It was done over at Baptist Hospital in Memphis. And then the medical examiner, having released jurisdiction, nevertheless, he's opening up in his mouth and saying that that Elvis Presley died because of an enlarged heart. I didn't know that Dr. Nikopoulos was saying that he died from colon problems. Yeah, he had colon problems, but he didn't die from that. The colon did not burst. He did not have peritonitis. Sure, he had a hell of a lot of discomfort from obstruction, but you don't die from that unless you go into metabolic failure and hepatic and renal failure and so on. He died from the effects of all the drugs that Dr. Nicopoulos prescribed for him. And today, I guarantee you, if that were to occur, Nicopoulos would have charges brought against him of a criminal nature, just as has been done now in a few other cases, and very likely, I don't know for sure, may happen in the Prince case. We'll see.
Why is it that in cases like Elvis Presley and JFK that people to this day, a lot of people believe there was a conspiracy, but if you ask most people, like Jim Lovell, who was there, they will tell you no. The mainstream media will tell you no. And it's
well, the mainstream media, keep in mind, they bought into this. New York Times et al., they bought into it. Some of them in the New York Times, they put out their own books, they ran their own stuff and so on. They committed themselves early on. They have a very deep, seated commitment here. And as far as Lavelle and others and so on, some of them just don't know. They haven't studied it. Others just believe if the government tells you this, the Warren Commission report, high level. I mean, I can't answer. Everybody has their own reasons and so on. I deal with the facts. Here's a question I'll leave with you. You can follow up another day. Ask your listeners to tell you in your next program, what was the distance, and ask him not to cheat, look up what was the distance of the fatal shot that killed Robert Kennedy. How far was the gun from Robert Kennedy's head when he was shot? Sirhan was there. You remember the scenario. Kennedy's just won the primary in California. He's walking out through the kitchen area of the Ambassador Hotel. Sirhan is in front of him, and Sirhan shoots as Kennedy is walking forward toward him, right? That's the scenario. You recall that, right?
I do, yes.
Okay, how far? Well, I'll ask you. Go ahead. How far was Sirhan gun from Kennedy?
I would guess...
Give me just a range.
A few feet, I would imagine.
Okay, some people say 2 feet, 5 feet, 10 feet, 8 feet, 6 feet. What if I tell you, and it's documented, check it out, we'll talk again. Officially, in the autopsy report, I was a consultant, others were consultants and so on, including three military forensic pathologists. The shot that killed Robert Kennedy was fired 1 to 1.5 inches away from his head behind the right ear and had a slightly forward trajectory, okay? How does that fit in with your memory? So when you ask, and it's a good question, how come people and what do they know? Well, there you are. I deal with facts. And anybody wants to dispute the facts, then come up with the reasons. I've given you the trajectory of the single bullet theory. I didn't get a chance to tell you that the bullet, having left pieces of itself in three anatomic locations, had a weight loss of only 1.5% after having broken two large bones in John Kennedy, emerged near pristine with no deformation except at the base from the impact of the firing mechanism. Those are facts. So ask Mr. Lavelle and others how to deal with those.
Before we wrap up here with just 3 minutes left, and just to touch on it for a second because it's another high-profile case, Martin Luther King Jr., how did that play out?
Martin Luther King Jr., in my opinion, is another case in which we've shown that the shots could not have been fired from that place. The whole scenario, of course, stinks from beginning to end with James Earl Ray, and I was consulted in that case. In fact, I went down and did a second autopsy with the medical examiner on James Earl Ray when he died. This is a fascinating case. This multiple loser, a guy with no background at all, and his escapades when he gets out of jail for a year, going to Canada and Britain with documents that would make 007 green with envy and so on. A guy who was penniless, who had never been involved in any matters involving racial issues and so on. And then when you get to the actual shooting itself and the trajectory of the shots, et cetera, Martin Luther King's assassination was, I know people, you got to say, well, Wecht is a conspiratorialist, but just, I want to close with this. Think and set aside your politics. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative. I don't care. Just set that aside. Set that aside. Let's deal with hard reality. Who were three people that you could not shut up in any way? John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. Hoover tried with King to destroy him with extramarital sexual affairs and everything like that. And Hoover, at the height of his power, could not bring Martin Luther King down. How do you shut him up? How do you defeat the Kennedys at the polls. Robert Kennedy was going to be the Democratic nominee, having won the California primary. Okay, how do you deal with that? Just think about that, setting aside your politics, okay? So there is the answer to your question. You have the same four, I'm not telling you the same exact people, obviously not, but the same forces of a socio-political, philosophical nature, and so on. And that's the way you deal with it. You have no alternative. And that's what those cases are all about, and that's why and when you say the news media and others, the fact of the matter is that in every national poll that has been taken since the first one ever on John F. Kennedy, anywhere from 65% to 85% of the American public has rejected the Warren Commission report. So sure, the news media, they bought in, and they're stuck with it, but not the American public.
With 30 seconds left, Dr. Wick, in the Martin Luther King case, why could James Earl Ray not have made that shot? Where did that shot come from?
The shot came from lower down and fired up at the balcony there of the Lorraine Motel. I'm not telling you that it's physically impossible. The James Earl Ray is a whole story, too, conveniently leaving the gun with his fingerprints because he felt, gee, it wasn't fair. How would anybody ever think of him? So he had to leave the gun with the fingerprints instead of just taking it with him in the Mustang car, which he was able to travel from Tennessee all the way up to Canada. Nobody bothered him and so on, but he had to leave the gun with his fingerprints. Think about that.
Dr. Cyril Rick, this has been absolutely fascinating, and
we'll
watch the show.
Pleasure to be with you, and we'll talk again sometime.
I hope so. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Dr. Cyril Weck, boy, a lot to think about there. Hey, this is Scott Spears for this day, heading for the dugout. Stay tuned for more programming.
So much play.
You know what I think, actually.